morning, please be seated. The first case on this panel's oral argument docket this morning is David Vujagas versus State of Nevada. Actually, State of Nevada versus, it should be David Vujagas versus State of Nevada, excuse me. 59383, Mr. Strong, are you ready to proceed?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. All right, just a brief introduction. First of all, Bo Sterling on behalf of the appellant, David Vujagas. Mr. Vujagas was convicted on multiple counts of lewdness with a child under the age of 14. He did and he has maintained his innocence throughout, and that was his defense at the trial, that he didn't commit these acts that were alleged against him. So under those circumstances, the testimony of the witnesses obviously was a crucial aspect of this case with regard to whether or not the alleged acts of lewdness occurred. This court's not here to retry the facts, but I'm going to go into them just a little tiny bit, if with the court's indulgence, unless you have any questions, because these factual issues are important to some of the issues, the jury instructions, and some of the other issues where he needs to prove prejudice. And really what I want to point out for the court is that Mr. Vujagas had an expert to testify on his behalf, the only expert at the trial, Dr. Donahue, a psychiatrist, and he was an expert in child sexual abuse, and also in particular with regard to false testimony by children in sexual abuse cases, and the indicia and factors that would go to weighing whether or not testimony was truthful. He didn't testify as the ultimate facts of the case, as that would be improper under the precedence of this court. But he did give the jury what they needed in order to weigh the testimony of Addison, the child who was 4, then 5 years old during the period of time alleged in the information. And what Dr. Donahue said is that children in this particular age range are particularly susceptible to suggestion by grown-ups, and that the statistics and the studies show that in the context of a case like this, where we have allegations of child sexual abuse by a parent, in the context of a divorce and child custody battle, that the false positive rate can be as high as 12%. So the jury had that information when they were listening to the testimony at trial. He also went into some of the factors that the jury could use in weighing whether or not these allegations were in fact true, including the inconsistencies in the testimony by the alleged victim, something called the halo effect, when one parent is saying a lot of bad things about the other parent, and the child believes those things, and the child is much more likely to believe other things about that parent, even if those other things may not be true. He also talked about some other things, and I don't want to go through all this for the court, unless you like me to, but even among grown-ups with certain kinds of interviewing techniques, you can have false positive rates, meaning you can suggest people things to people and have them believe them. The majority of people will start to believe certain things, and in some studies it was as high as 70 to 90%. And this is all in the transcripts and in our briefs. But I want to provide that as some background so that when we're looking at the other issues, that the court has some context for understanding why these other errors that we've alleged are prejudicial for Mr. Vujagas and entitle him to a new trial. If the court doesn't have any questions, I'll go ahead and start with the first argument that we make, which is in the brief with regard to Dr. O'Donohue. And that was there were refusal of the district court judge to certify or designate Dr. O'Donohue as an expert in front of the jury. Again, Dr. O'Donohue was the only expert at the trial. Nevertheless, the court did not allow the jury to hear either that he was an expert or otherwise qualified to give opinion testimony in any manner different than the other witnesses at the trial.
Why don't you go into how he was presented to the jury?
He simply just started giving his opinion testimony, and once the normal voir dire background information was done, Ms. Burke started to make a motion to have him certified as an expert, and there was an objection, and the objection was sustained, that he would not be allowed, that she, the attorney, would not be allowed to have the jury hear that Dr. O'Donohue was an expert. And of course, under this
statute... But he did testify in front of the jury.
He did testify, absolutely.
Did the statement, do you strike the testimony?
No. He was allowed to testify. He was allowed to give...
But he was to strike it afterwards because he was found not to be an expert.
No, not at all, Your Honor. That's not the issue here. It's a good point, and it's a distinction worth making. The issue is not that he didn't get to testify. It's the jury wasn't allowed, and Mr. Villegas, the attorney, wasn't allowed to make the argument that Dr. O'Donohue had what the statute requires for an expert, that he is uniquely qualified in a particular field, that he has information, opinion, testimony that would be of usefulness to the jury, and also, and this is key in deciding whether or not this kind of error is something that's going to be allowed by this court, the third part of the statute is the jury has to understand what the limitation is, the scope of the expert testimony, and how to apply it to the facts and what it applies to and what it doesn't apply to. Because the court didn't tell the jury that this person is an expert entitled to give opinion testimony, the jury didn't know what, other than getting it from the testimony itself, didn't know that the court had approved Dr. O'Donohue to testify to as to the scope of his expertise.
Did the defense attorney offer the stock instruction on expert testimony that we always give in criminal cases?
Well, that's an interesting point, Your Honor, and this is discussed in our briefs. It was part of the packet with the standard stock jury instructions, the stock expert instruction. Ms. Burke, defendant's counsel, said she didn't want the instruction given. And her reasoning was the jury hadn't heard anybody called an expert, and that would be confusing instruction. Now, that's not getting that. She would have, here's the point I need to make. She wasn't going to get, Mr. Villegas wasn't going to get the benefit of that instruction because it refers to expert testimony. We had never heard anybody called an expert.
On that point, Mr. Yes. Sterling, my understanding is that Dr. Donohue was referred to by your client's trial counsel as an expert. He was called Dr. Donohue, and your client's trial counsel referred to him as an expert in closing arguments. Is that all okay?
I know that during opening statement, Mr. Villegas' counsel said, you're going to hear from our expert.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall seeing it in
the... So the jury was told, at least in opening, by your recollection, that they would be hearing from an expert testifying on Mr. I apologize for the pronunciation. Villegas?
Yes, Villegas.
Villegas' counsel. Is that right?
Yes, there were loose references to experts, and that's part of the confusion and the prejudice here, because the same can be said for...
What do you say then about this court's decision in Mulder and the comment that was made in the footnote in that case that seems to track the expert witness statute that doesn't call for the designation by the trial court of an expert as certified as an expert. They're simply qualifying the expert through qualifications and voir dire to testify and give expert testimony, but the trial court doesn't sanction the individual as an expert, does it? And even if it did matter, what is the error? Simply because the district court doesn't say this witness is an expert, how is your client prejudiced in this case?
Mr. Villegas was prejudiced because Dr. O'Donohue was the only person qualified by the court to give opinion testimony. There were some loose references to him as an expert, as you mentioned, but the therapist that the Addison saw, there were three or four references to her. She referred to herself as an expert several times. No objections. There were loose references, but they were obviously giving testimony. There was a lot of background information given about their qualifications. There's a split of authority, Your Honor, and there's, I don't know if you want to call it a movement, but there's certainly a strong point of view from some courts that the designation of an expert should not be given at all in front of the jury, that nobody should be called an expert, that we should simply have people designated as opinion witnesses. But still, the court needs to make some sort of a ruling in front of the jury so that the jury understands that this person is uniquely qualified to give testimony by way of opinion that other witnesses are not, even if they appear to be experts from the lay perspective of the jury.
Was the judge acting as a gatekeeper with this witness, or was she just misreading Mulder? I know a lot about Mulder. I was the trial attorney.
Yeah. Well, getting back to Mulder, first, Mulder isn't dispositive on this issue, and usually it comes up from the other side when the state is trying to bring in the experts for firearms and whatever. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I got sidetracked. The question was?
Did she rely on, in other words, was she acting as a gatekeeper and saying this wasn't expert testimony, or was she saying Mulder says I don't have to say this person's an expert?
Well, the record is funny because there's a reference to a case, but it's never stated what the case is on the record. Simply this new case where we're not allowed to have an expert designation on the record, but of course there's no case that says that in Nevada. This is really an issue before the court that needs to be decided. But no, it was not a gatekeeper function at all. He was allowed to give all the testimony that that Ms. Burke wanted to elicit from him. The prejudice was that the defendant didn't get the benefit of having the jury assess his testimony differently and uniquely from the other professionals that testified.
I wish you had put in the jury instruction, though. I mean, that makes it. Double sign sounds like a waiver of some type.
Well, I think it's it's not a waiver because once the court made a ruling saying that you can't refer to him as expert, I'm not going to tell the jury he's an expert, then the trial attorney has to deal with the court's ruling.
Well, see.
And at that point, it seemed that the instruction would be more prejudicial than helpful. That part of it's a tactical decision, but she was thrust into that situation. She should have had to. She should have had the benefit of that instruction. Would have certainly if she were allowed to. If the court gave the expert designation, I'd like to save the rest of my time if I may.
Okay. Mr. McDonald, how are you doing?
Excellent. Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Ryan Joe McDonald, representing the state of Nevada. I think the issues were pretty well briefed in this case, so I had a few things that I wanted to expand upon or comment on. I suppose I'll start with the expert, since that was the majority of the discussion during the appellant's time. What we're talking about here is simply the use of the word, the magic word, expert. That was the only limitation placed on Dr. Donohue's testimony. The only limitation was on counsel's qualification of him using that magic word, expert, and as Justice Hardesty noted, counsel did it anyway, despite the court's order that it was apparently done at this unrecorded bench conference. But Donohue was allowed to tell the jury that he's published 60 books, that he's published hundreds of articles, that he runs a child sex assault clinic at the University of Nevada, Reno, where he's a clinical professor of psychology. And he was allowed to comment pretty extensively on the victim's actual testimony and elements of the victim's testimony that could possibly comport with coaching or the parents' installation of possible false memories. And he was allowed to opine and basically speculate that the victim may be misremembering the abuse.
So even if it was, even if we consider it's error, as far as you're concerned, it's absolutely harmless because he testified.
It's absolutely harmless, and I don't think it's error because that specific footnote in Mulder that I think Judge Adair was referring to says that the district court shall not promote or denigrate the credibility of a witness by using the term expert. So promote or denigrate seems to me that it indicates it's good for them and it's good for us.
After Mulder, both civil and criminal cases, at least in Clark County when I was a district judge, used the expert designation, the expert jury instruction.
And the word expert is in the jury instruction, the word expert is in the statute. So I think the district court was trying to toe that line, and the only limitation she said is that we're going to call this opinion testimony. But the substance of the testimony was not limited in any way.
That's the key. The jury did hear it.
Yes.
And they should call it, you know, if it walks like a duck and looks like a duck, I guess it's the duck. Mulder, so that the both of you understand and so my colleagues understand, the problem with the Mulder expert was he was really a handwriting expert, and I had him testify as the fingerprints. So they, and again, that he got to testify as to what he thought about the fingerprints in the Mulder case, so it came in front of the jury, wasn't stricken or anything. But the DA did not, were you the trial attorney?
I was not, no.
I just wondered if the trial attorney wanted to strike the testimony for any reason. It doesn't sound like it. Doesn't sound like the judge was acting as a gatekeeper in this case because the testimony was given, and it just over designation.
Well, I think the judge was acting as a gatekeeper in the sense that she found that this witness could testify as an expert without using the qualification expert.
So she was acknowledging the language in Mulder in footnote 2 that says courts must take care not to use terms such as qualified as an expert or certified as an expert when referring to the witness in the presence of the jury.
Exactly, and she was very careful to say, I want to offer this as opinion testimony. That's the qualification.
And as to that point, I guess that's the question, is whether or not the court impinged this witness by not allowing counsel to refer to the witness as an expert. It's one thing for the court not to make the designation. The question is whether the court limited counsel from calling the doctor an expert.
And I don't see the substantive impact there. You know, whether the
question is, did the court do that, though? Did the court limit counsel?
The court limited counsel from using the term expert, although counsel went ahead and used it sometimes anyway.
With a mold of reading that, then we have these stock instructions that refer to expert. How is a jury, a set of lay people, to then opine whether this person is just, quote, someone who's spouting their opinion versus someone with qualifications?
It's tricky because, of course, he is saying that he is an expert without using the word expert. He is saying that he has all of these publications. He has testified in over 100 trials, mostly for the defense, that he runs the sexual assault clinic, that he's done all of this research, that he's on the cutting edge with, you know, formulating new interview techniques to eliminate possible bias when child victims are testifying.
So the jury just see this as somebody who's a paid witness. They come in, they testify to whatever whoever calls them wants because they're being paid for it.
I don't
background. Or do they have sufficient wherewithal to give a valid opinion?
I think if you say that you are a professor of clinical psychology and you have all of these credentials and you basically regurgitate your CV for the jury and tell the jury, this is why I'm credible. It's not because I'm just saying, oh, I'm an expert. I think actually that's less credible, saying, oh, I'm an expert, take my word for it. No, let me prove it to you. So substantively, there's no difference, and in fact, it could be advantageous.
And I remember in the past, they'd give their CV, they'd give all that information, they'd be asked if they'd been offered as an expert in prior testimony or anything of that nature. At the end of it, whether the court acknowledges it or not, and the jury then can, after they hear the testimony, give it the weight they think is appropriate. But when you're limiting counsel in terms of how counsel can do what they're going to do as to the relevance of that testimony, it raises a concern.
I think in our Grooming case, we had a Grooming case recently, which was a 4-3 decision on affirming that an expert could testify as to grooming. I think we called him an expert. The majority did, and I think the jury instruction was given. So I don't know if we actually eviscerated Mulder.
I don't see any harm or advantage either way, to be blunt. I don't think that limiting counsel in qualifying this witness as an expert has any impact. But if you were to clarify Mulder and say, for instance, the defense can call their witnesses experts if they're qualified by the district court as such, I don't think that would have any impact one way or another.
And because what Mulder says, I'm not sure it needs to be clarified. First of all, it's in a footnote, but secondly, Mulder itself says it's referring to the court, not to the parties. In this case, apparently the claim of error is that the court applied it to the parties, but even after she applied it to the parties, the defense still made the argument. So,
and the state didn't bother rejecting
the
case.
If I may, Mr. McDonald.
Excuse me?
I'd like to move on to a separate issue, if I may. In reading the information in this case, it looks to me like the first, second, and fourth counts in the information read identically. I'm concerned about, and wanted the state to comment on, the fact that under Valentine and some other cases, there doesn't appear to be any distinguishing periods of time or other specifications between these various acts that are charged. What is your view on this?
The timeline is given in the pleading as May 2007 to September of 2008. So that is the
that timeline is the same timeline that applies to all three counts.
Correct.
So how would a defendant distinguish between an act of lewdness in count one versus an act of lewdness in count two versus an act of lewdness in count four? I don't see how a defendant could defend against those or know which ones separate the others.
That time period is during the period of visitation. So the defendant knows that timeline represents the periods during which he had intermittent visitation with the girls. So those weekends over that 1.5 year time period is the specificity. And this court has noted in the past that what is not required is guessing the exact day that a certain event happened with specificity. I think that's Cunningham, because of the inherent problems that you are very aware of with child witnesses and victims of sexual assault in specifying this happened specifically at Dylan's house at 9:30 p.m. on May 12th, 2007. Versus another count that happened on June 30th or something.
Right. It may not be under Cunningham that it's necessary to specify the exact date or time, but it seems to me that this case presents an interesting question of whether you at least need to provide separate time periods for each of the separate counts. I think this particular information is so broad it fails to inform the defendant as to which act of rudeness he's supposed to defend against at which period of time. I mean, mean, what would have precluded? The child testified in this case that this event occurred every time she visited her father.
Yes.
So what would prevent the state from repeating the language in count one for about 300 counts or however many days she was at the residence during that 17-month period? I don't know how one would defend that.
Well, if we believe the child witness, if we say that the child witness testimony is, and the witness was very convincing, especially for a child of her age. You know, she was confronted with reading back her previous statements, and she was very engaged, responsive, and fluent. That kind of goes to the competency issue that I was going to talk about. But specifically,
a due process question.
Right.
Has the information provided adequate specificity to the defendant to understand the charges of which he has been charged?
Because the victim testified that this happened every time during the period when he lived at Darren Archer's house and then during the period where he lived at his parents' house. So it is possible, if we believe the witness, that you could have many, many more counts than four or five. Now, the increased specificity requirement that you might be suggesting doesn't really do anything to eliminate that. If you say, during the period of Darren Archer's, I think that was May 2007 to December 2007, during that time period, if we calculate every weekend, and let's say it's 15 weekends, and it happened every night, times three, let's call that 45 times. And in the pleading, we say, we allege those 45 times happened between, somewhere between May 2007 and December 2007 at 2200 Sunview or wherever Darren Archer's house was at. I think, given the problems with child victims of sexual assault, that is often about as specific as you can possibly be without getting into a very new requirement that, like I said before, we're going to allege that this specific count happened on this specific day.
Well, let me give you this hypothetical, and it relates to some of the testimony in this case. Let's assume for the moment there were 45 counts of lewdness based upon the math that you just provided. There was also testimony from the victim in this case that one of these incidents in which he allegedly touched her occurred while she was on the opposite side of the room. Suppose the jury rejected that testimony as simply not possible. Which one of the counts would they acquit him on when they all read the same?
One of the counts. One of the counts charged. In fact, they did acquit him of one of the counts charged in this case.
So how do you distinguish between that count and the other three?
Unfortunately, this is an inherent problem when you're talking about child sex assault cases. Mm-hmm. If we are going to prosecute these cases as a community, then there has to be some kind of flexibility, and that's what the court in Cunningham, I think, was getting at.
How is the state limited, though, in its prosecution, Mr. McDonald, if it says, well, as to count one, this act of lewdness occurred between May 2007 and July 2007?
I would say
that. In count two, it says this act occurred between August 2007 and October of 2007, and so on.
I think the state is inherently limited by the number of times the defendant victimized the child. That is the limitation.
Okay. Just one last question, if you don't mind. What is your view of the testimony that supports the conviction in count three? What is the best testimony, or the best, not the best, but the sufficient evidence that supports the conviction in count three, in your view?
Count three is the attempt.
The attempted, yes.
The victim testified, I believe she testified it was one of the first instances when she was at Darren Archer's house and it was nighttime, and she woke up to the defendant fondling her, and then She swatted him away when he tried to do it again, and then he stopped, but then was successful in perpetrating another lewdness upon her.
I thought the testimony was that she attempted to swat him away, but was unsuccessful.
My understanding of the testimony is that she was successful in initially swatting him away, but then he came back after her initial success in getting his hand away a moment in time, and then he was successful in completing the act of lewdness.
If the testimony were otherwise, if she attempted to swat him away but was unsuccessful, would you agree that that wouldn't support an attempt conviction?
If the testimony were that he was reaching over and she tried to swat him away, but he was successful in completing an act of lewdness, then the attempt would merge.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. McDonald. Do my colleagues have any other questions?
I was thinking about sexual assault cases. If somebody tries to insert a penis into a vagina and fails, and then they're able to do it, would you charge him with attempted sexual assault and sexual assault? I mean, that's what you seem to be saying here.
That is possible, yes.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. Mr. Sterling, your final arguments?
Thank you, Your Honor. And that discussion that just occurred on several points are in our brief. I don't want the court to misunderstand that we think those are unimportant, but I refer the court back to the arguments that we made. Certainly with regard to the information, we have several issues that arise out of the lack of specificity in the information, including the proposed jury instruction that would have added a sentence. Following Cunningham, you don't have to be exact and precise because we are dealing with a child witness, but you have to have some degree of specificity, some particularity. This case presents not just the extreme fringe of an information that lacks specificity, but it crosses the line and should not be permissible. So we brief that issue, and it's an important one. It also goes to some of the other arguments in our brief, including the fact that... did you have a question, Judge?
No.
Okay. The truth of the matter is, Addison was only able, really, to testify to one incident. So if the state came in as a practical matter and really latched on to this notion that the abuse happened every single time she was at her father's house, the jury would have clearly found that to be incredible and rejected it, which is why they didn't emphasize that point. Shiloh, the sister, said she only witnessed one act. There were other people in the house. It was not usual for him to be sleeping in the bed with the girls. Rose and LaPierre deal with the particularity issue, and they give the court some guidance on how this is. You have to show something in order to focus those counts. And here, the first time that Villegas' counsel learned of what those counts were was a closing argument done by the government, and that's when they laid it out. Count one is this time period, and et cetera.
Okay.
Do you have any other questions?
Any questions by my colleagues? Okay, Mr. Sterling, Mr. McDonald, thank you for your arguments this morning and your briefing in this matter. The case will stand submitted. We'll be in recess. Thank you.